My name is Stuart Wakefield. I wrote a paper for the Masters in History with the Open University because since retiring, I actually have discovered history and I had no interest in it until I retired. I was living in Kuala Lumpur after I retired, and almost out of boredom, I became a guide in the National Museum. And I suddenly found that the story of the history of Malaysia, or Malaya as it really was going to be called originally, really fascinated me. And so when I came back to the UK, I decided that this is what I would like to focus on now I'm retired, when in principle I've got all the time in the world and I can dedicate it to this history.
Okay, so what was it, you know, what? Tell us a bit about Malaya. It was a British colony, wasn't it? And there was a bit of a fight, I believe, there with the Chinese after the war.
Absolutely. That was what I really wanted to study for my master's, which was called the confrontation. They didn't call it war, because for insurance purposes, insurers wouldn't pay out. So they called it a confrontation. Sorry, they called it an emergency. Confrontation came afterwards. They called it an emergency so they could still claim. This went on from about 1948 through to about 1959. And in the beginning, it was against the communists. Local communists were actually talking about. And in the country, you have Chinese, and you have Indians, and Malays. And Malays began to realize in the 30s and 40s that they were becoming the lesser part of the population of the country, and the Chinese were beginning to take over. So there's a lot of aggravation between the different portions in the communities. So the Chinese communists, they started to support the local communists, who actually were quite adept at taking on the British, because the British were still thinking upon this as something similar to the war that they'd been fighting in Burma. Apart from the fact that everybody who had been fighting in Burma, I say everybody, but the huge proportion of them were now out and left the army. So they didn't have a lot of basis and understanding of what to do to fight these communists. And it took them about 2 or 3 years to get their act together before they started to, started to improve their way of learning. And eventually, the communists were forced deeper and deeper into the jungle, and they were almost starved out. So the story goes on through to the 1960s, just before Malaya declared independence, was given independence, rather. The British pulled out, but of course they kept the military presence in the area to try and keep the lid on everything. And then along came Indonesia and threatened the whole lot with their confrontation, which is another story, another 5 years.
I mean, one of the curious things that a lot of people scratch their head about is that, you know, obviously Singapore was really part of the Malay Peninsula. How come Singapore went its own way?
Singapore was actually originally going to be part of Malaysia. But eventually Lee Kuan Yew, he said that he thought that the country was actually getting a raw deal in what was becoming what was going to become Malaysia. It's the same actually with Brunei. The Sultan of Brunei decided eventually, when he thought about it, that he didn't want to join this conglomeration. So Malaysia became what was Malaya, and then Sarawak, and then British North Borneo. So it was. Not a dog's muddle, but a lot was going on to try and resolve it and to keep a lot of people happy. But Singapore decided to go independent, and there was nothing guaranteed when they did. I'm not saying that they were hard up, you know, but they were very clever, very astute people, and they eventually managed to make a huge success out of their independence. when it all started, there was nothing guaranteed that that was going to be the case.
Yeah, well, I imagine Malaysia, as it now is looking at Singapore rather jealously as to how they got on. But anyway, I must mention one of our guests, Barry Wynn, over the years. He died last year, sadly, but he was in the SAS over in Malaya and fought over there. And for anyone that is interested, there's his book, A King's Shilling, is an absolutely terrific read, and talks also about his father, who was Montgomery's chief of logistics for the 8th Army, which achieved one of the first victories for the Allies in the Second World War, which was El Alamein and the victory over Rommel in North Africa. So it's an absolutely rip-roaring read, and it includes his amazing escape from a V2, which blew up the factory that he was painting on the outside of, and blew him across a dual carriageway, and he just managed to pick himself up uninjured, amazingly. But anyway, so that's King's Shilling by Barry Wynn, if anyone is interested in this sort of Malaya. There's a lot of tales about his days over there and trying to beat the Chinese secret societies that were operating within Malaya, as it then was. But what do you make of this whole business of empire? Because it's become a very contentious issue, hasn't it? The idea that the British were terrible. In fact, Stuart, if you speak to many people that can actually remember the British Empire, they think that things have gone downhill since. Now, I'm not saying that's their fault, because there seem to have been other sort of financial techniques that have undermined many of these independent countries since the end of colonialism.
It's interesting you say that. I was going to talk the other day about responses to worldwide catastrophic events. And one of the ones that I got involved with, in fact, was the Ebola cyclone that hit what is now Bangladesh when it was East Pakistan, 1970. And there they were so, for want of a better phrase, so grateful to see the British come back that they put up a big sign in the airport in Dakar to say, welcome back, you know, more or less, please sort out this country. Amazing, yeah. Sorry, that wasn't what you were asking, really, was it?
I'm sorry, I just wondered, if you know, with your knowledge of that part of the world, what you make of that, because I wonder if there are, you know, if it really was just an awful, tortuous, evil empire that we had, or were there any kind of redeeming qualities at all?
Ah, many redeeming qualities, but at the end of the day, I mean, take India as a prime example. I mean, people want to make their own decisions, yeah. You know, and if something goes wrong, I mean, take the Amritsar massacre, for example. You know, in the big scheme of things, that wasn't a major event, is from the British point of view, but for the Sikhs, I mean, that is the ultimate in degradation and not British bullying, that's a terrible word to use. There's something far, far worse than, you know, the British just doing what they want. If you look at on the other side, if you look at some of the, positives, providing education, providing railway links, and providing a structure for society, you know, that's lots and lots of pluses, which are still recognised and still worth going to have a look at today. For, you know, in India, for example, but that was colonialism is far more than that. You know, it takes away people's independence and people get fed up with it. And if you look at the situation in 1945 at the end of the war, I mean, Britain's virtually bankrupt. You know, and it just cannot afford to actually have an empire, you know, so it has to start giving up left, right, and centre.
Yeah. And what do the Romans ever do for us? I always remember that phrase. Anyway, look, you're actually on here today to not to talk about abroad, but to talk about a bit of history here. And we've got the annual Imber Bus Day and the open days. It's a fascinating town, Imber. It's a little village, or was a little village. It's now controlled by the army in the middle of Salisbury Plain. That during World War II, people were evacuated from it, being told that, hang on, we need your village for training in the Second World War before D-Day, and it's okay, you can have your village and your homes back after the war, but apparently that never happened. So once a year, and I think at Christmas time too, occasionally, Imber is actually open to the public. But can you just tell us how, maybe starting with, why Salisbury Plain is where it is? Because, you know, this is Stonehenge, this is a big Neolithic area, and actually the army now controls most of it, don't they?
Three-fifths, by my calculation. Okay, so we're going back to the end of the 19th century when the War Office started to purchase land on Salisbury Plain, mostly over to the east, all of it at that time over to the east. The Army had always used Salisbury Plain for exercises, and when you're talking about, shall we say, 1860 onwards for about the next 40 years, 50 years. To them, exercises were perhaps a 3 or 4 day event. And people used to come and watch these exercises on a weekend. It was a big thing from Salisbury to go and watch the troops just marching up and down and turning left and turning right and listen to the bands playing. And that was what they used the plane for. But then they began to understand that it's an ideal place to, if they can, to do live firing. So things started to develop, and then in the 1930s, late 1928 onwards, they started to purchase more land over on the west, and that's when Imber, in fact, was purchased. And the people living in Imber became tenants of the War Office. Which was fine because the War Office wasn't interfering. In fact, that was seen as a huge plus because the War Office were actually much better landlords than the absentee landlords had been, who just wanted them to pay rent for their small holdings or what have you. The War Office actually took an interest. And one of the, to me, unsung heroes of all this that went on with Imber, in fact, was the, if you like, the War Office landlord, who had an office in Durrington, and he used to keep on reminding the War Office about the implications of some of the decisions they were making to make sure that the villagers were treated fairly. Not over fairly, but just had a reasonable deal, that was all. And then, of course, when you come to the Second World War, to start off with, Imber's not impacted tremendously. Germans were flying over occasionally. There was a couple of bombs that were dumped there. You know that the Germans, if they had some bombs, if they would just release them. They didn't care where they landed, just to try and do some damage to something. So that's all that Imber really had to put up with until at the end of 1943, when the Americans started to arrive, that the situation was such that the Americans demanded some space. They probably had Texas in mind or something, where they could do live firing. The War Office considered three options. You had the Hampshire Downs, Pentland Hills, or Imber. And Imber was an obvious choice because they owned it. You know, so, I mean, it wouldn't be a question of having to push people out. All they had to do was say, your tenancy is finished. Which they did. So they had a meeting in the November the 1st, I think it was, in 1943, where all the heads of household, in fact, the entire village, more or less, attended. And they gave them all a letter that told them what was going to happen. Now, the contents of this letter became very much disputed as time went on, because this letter promised them that they would just be a temporary departure. No, it didn't, because there's a chap who was actually going to a meeting. He left this meeting early, stuffed this letter in his pocket, and this surfaced about 1946-47 to show what the war office actually did say. And it wasn't that they could guarantee to come back, you know. They used to have phrases like, you know, when the situation resolves itself, you know, they would be happy for them to come back. But of course, it never did resolve itself.
But I mean, I wonder, Stuart, because maybe there's hardly, I would say there's probably nobody left who can remember that meeting, that there was something different said at the meeting that may have been on the piece of paper.
Oh, absolutely. But then you talk about verbal commitments. But I have a little theory here. There were a couple of army lieutenants who went round. You can imagine this. I mean, they didn't make decisions, lieutenants. Some colonels and people at the chain. So they told them to go there and just make sure everybody understands what's going on, to just help them to move, because they're going to close down. A lot of the husbands are away in the military, and what have you. So these two lieutenants, they went round and they concentrated actually on the old people, you know, to convince them that they should go because it was in the national interest, you know, the ill-defined national interest. So what they've done, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if they made it a little bit, you know, of the story, just to give them the impression that they would be coming back, that it would be guaranteed. This wasn't their remit, you know. Goodness me, you try and backtrack upon that to find out who these couple of guys were, these two lieutenants, you know, even at the end of the war. I mean, probably the names were never written down upon any record. It was just they went there to do a bit of hand holding and then come back and have another job.
How many people were involved?
140. Yeah, maybe 120.
And one of the interesting things, of course, is that there's actually a church there where services are still, even to this day, what's that, 80 years later, still being held?
Yes. Natural fact, the Bishop of Salisbury did have a meeting where they seriously considered, you know, that they would deconsecrate that church and work with the army to move, if you like, the stained glass windows to that other church, the church records to another church, the furniture, etc., to move it all out. But the big stumbling block, in fact, obvious when you think about it, was a graveyard where all these villagers obviously had been buried for many years. And of course, the families were going to say, you know, are you going to disinter my grandfather, whatever it might be? No, I didn't think they wanted to go that far, you know, to have the church actually recommended that the church, the parish church, the village church, could be given up. It was quite astounding. It usually didn't follow it through. It didn't sound actually a very churchy thing to do. One thing worth bearing in mind, in fact, that most of the villagers were chapel people rather than church. That's quite interesting. In between the wars, you know, was that the chapel, the Baptist chapel, it really started to gather momentum in Imber. So the bits that were never actually sold to the war office never owned was the church, the plot that the church lies on, the school, and the Baptist chapel, and the pub. And the pub, yes, they never owned the pub. And good old ushers were still renewing the license, I think, up until about 1947.
I mean, it's also a manor house there, yeah. Would you say a school, a chapel, a church. I mean, it's a reasonable-sized village. What remains of any of this now?
Well, most of it's been knocked down apart from the church, because they, you must be aware, I'm sure, that they wanted to use it initially for street pointing. Okay, and as various requirements for street fighting developed over the years, you know, you've got to look at where they were fighting wars, you know, for example, in Aden, in Indonesia, they were fighting, all the different conflicts that we say that have occurred since 1945, they've actually developed the village to reflect the type of area that their troops would be fighting in. So there was different variations on the village, you know, a Palestinian village, a Far East village, an African village, whatever suited them at the time. But of course, not the church. They didn't touch the church.
Just over near, I think, isn't it near Chittan? There's what we always used to call, when I lived in Salisbury, Tin City, which is actually quite a reasonable sized town, which is kitted out like that. So I wonder, is there really any need to use Imber for that sort of thing nowadays?
Oh, yeah. They own it. That's the point. There was a big discussion going on in the papers at the time where the War Office was challenged, you know, said, well, goodness me. When you go into a state, you've got to think back to the situation 1945, 46, 47. Tremendous shortages of food, tremendous shortage of housing because of all the bombing and what have you. And lo and behold, you look at Imber and say, well, hang on, there's about 80-odd houses here. You know, there's housing for maybe about 200 people to push. And, you know, the land all around could be used for growing crops, but there's nobody here to grow them. So that's where the push was coming from. And that's what the War Office, they made a decision by about 1947 that they were going to hang on to this, that this and that, there was a huge advantage to having this, to not having Imber occupied or any residence in Imber. That was tremendously well into their thinking by about 1947, but they didn't want to admit it openly at that time. They discussed it, and it's on the record of their meetings, but they just wanted people to think that it was still just a bit, it could happen, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wonder, were there any of the former villagers that really made a fuss about this, a stink about this, that they really, you know, were insisting that they should be allowed to go back?
The villagers themselves were not prominent in the popping up in the discussion, if I can put it that way. And I've searched for their names and for what they actually said themselves, but there were an awful lot of people speaking for them. Okay, and then people used to write you know, very valid newspaper articles, you know, about saying, well, what would be the value of it? The cost now, the world's changed. You know, you've now got to put in running water, sanitation that we never had before, etc. You know, you've now got to provide electricity. You know, you've got to provide a lot of facilities. It's still in the middle of nowhere. You know, and the big thing to carry this forward would be young people. And young people don't want to live there. That was the claim.
Well, you're probably right, actually. Right. I mean, youngsters certainly want to be where there's plenty of people around. There's hardly any there at all. So when the Americans arrived, they used the case, used the area, that part of Salisbury Plain for many years, did they?
By the January 1944, 6 months before D-Day, there was about 750,000 Americans in Britain. I'm not saying that they weren't all on Salisbury Plain. Some of them were on the beaches, you know, and some of them were in East Anglia. And what have you. But that was a total number. And they were actually quite respectful of the places where they were. They used to drive on the wrong side of the road, which used to amuse before it got to the annoying stage, and dry their tanks a bit too fast and not doing all the hedges. But in actual fact, the villagers liked them quite a lot. And that's the villages apart from Imber, you know, who'd been emptied. Imber had been emptied by then. Before that, in 1943, that was when the first load of Americans came. They actually thought they were fantastic because they were not only very respectful. They used to get, for example, the villagers to do their washing. And they would give them some fruit or some cigarettes in exchange. And if somebody from the village said, you know, would you like to stop and have a cup of tea and have tea with us, you know, they used to politely turn down the invitation because they knew that these people were so hard up and there was such a shortage of food. And it wouldn't be appropriate for them to say yes. And they were admired very much for that. And when eventually they began to pack up, and start moving down towards the coast to start getting ready for the assault. They gave a lot of their personal possessions that they couldn't pack to the villagers and the people around the plain. Yeah. So, Yeah, so they go on very well.
And what about over the decades? Was there any real campaign for people to come back to live in the village? Were there real efforts to do that?
Oh, yeah. There was a very important campaign for the reinstatement of Imber. Gathered momentum, actually, in the very early 60s. And this was actually run by a chap from the Salisbury area. And what they were doing was what we would call today a mass trespass. And they accumulated, I forget the exact number, but I mean, don't quote me. Say, don't quote me. But I think something like about 2,000 or 3,000 people were going to go from the edge of Salisbury Plain down to the village of Imber. And what happened was they didn't on purpose ask for permission to do this. And of course, the Ministry of Defence, sorry, the War Office, yeah, it was still the War Office. The War Office were told, well, actually, grant them retrospective permission to do this. Don't give them what we want or take them to court. You know, so it was an interesting way of handling this. And just a little sideline, the Minister of Defence at that time was this John Profumo, who you may well have heard of. John Profumo, he was quite anti this group who was going to sort out the problem with Imber. But at the end of the day, I think authority higher than him said, oi, you know, just calm down. And this thing will disappear. So it began to be a public inquiry, for want of a better expression, to see which way all this could go. Could they really claim the rights to get access to Imber? I mean, that's what they were trying to do, just to get access. You know, and then perhaps the momentum would grow from the people who used to live there. Say, actually, could we go back and live there in my old days? Perhaps something like that. But initially, they had the backing of the council, CPRE, Council for the Preservation of Rural England, the local county council, other departments. Can't think exactly who it was now, but there were other national bodies, if you like, who wanted to get involved at the beginning. But eventually, they got whittled away, and even the CPRE. Didn't turn out to give evidence. So it was actually carried against them. But the War Office was actually told to be a little bit more conciliatory and allow, if you like, access once or twice a year, hence these buses that are going there, they still accept, to allow people to come and see what it was like. They didn't reject the possibility that people can live there, but everybody realised in that, you know, 1960.
Very practical. I mean, it's amazing. It sounds like a fun trespass, and it's quite a distance, really. Say, I mean, probably the nearest town is going to be Warminster, I imagine, which is an 8-mile trek across the plain. Well, I hope the weather's decent for a journey like that and back again.
Well, hang on, the postman used to do it every day.
On foot?
8 miles from Codford, the postman used to come and bring the mail and then sit in this little hut for a couple of hours, wait till anybody wants to give him mail to send back. Going back to the early part of the 20th century.
Amazing as well, of course. You know, you hinted earlier on that we would have got the water from Wells. No mains water, nothing like that.
No, and the doctor as well used to come that 8 miles from Codford before the First World War, definitely.
Okay, so what is the extent of access? With the Imber Bus Day, which is organised by what the boss, I believe, of Network Rail, is for some reason decides that, you know, this is his hobby. You know, he gets the buses down there, even though he's a railway man, and does a 1-day timetable right across, you know, from all sorts of different directions, from the western part of Salisbury Plain. Down into I think it's imberbus.co.uk is the website, I believe. And so there's a timetable up there for anyone that wants to see it. So that is one day where there is access for buses, not for motorcycles, not for push bikes, not for anything else but buses, no cars. Yep. But there are other days when those roads are open, aren't they, from Warminster and up to Gore Cross, etc.
Well, I visited, I think I've been there three times, and it's always been with the army. Yeah, the army is offered the opportunity.
Yeah, but there are public access days. I believe it's...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It's August, most of August, it's open with the red flags are down, most of August, I believe. And Easter time, there's usually a few days or a week, Easter week, and also over Christmas. So, I mean, you have to go and check the Army's own website for the specific dates, but yeah. It is reasonably open. And why would anyone actually want to go and visit it?
Why would you? Well, once you get the sniff of the story, you know, you're actually visiting somewhere where you can't go openly any day of the year that you like. So it becomes intriguing for that reason. There are things to see.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, one of the things is there's a rather lovely cafe they set up in the church from time to time, which is well worth visiting. And also, it's this amazing sort of situation where you've got a services sometimes taking place in a church, which is in an abandoned village in the middle of an army training range. And there's something I think quite poignant about, you know, even though the army is training all around, you've actually got, you know, church services going on in the middle of it.
Yes. I think in truth, when I've been with the army, I've never seen the evidence of it, never seen the evidence of the army. When I think about travelling roads on salty plain, you know, with tanks crossing and what have you, I've never seen a tank crossing a road in my life, which is absolutely amazing, you know, because they're all over the place in big numbers.
Yeah, in fact, you can see burnt out tanks on the bus journey.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
from the side. Anyway, I know you know your a dissertation, I think, was on this. Can you just give us its title? Because I'm sure some people may want to see it, and I will be perhaps sending it out or making it available via my show page on thisweek.org.uk this week. So just tell us a little bit about that, beginning with the title.
Okay, I've called it A Tale of Two Villages, which of course is derived from the Tale of Two Cities, if you like. But this is talking about Concord and Imber, who are very close neighbours, starting off in the 19th century, where they were both on their knees, they were both shrinking dramatically. They were basically agricultural villages, but they were agriculture was on its knees. The likes of the railway at Swindon was becoming a much more positive employer, for want of a better expression, and that's the way they were going. They were the if you look at the censuses, they were definitely on the way down to extinction. But then the First World War came along, and Codford suddenly found itself surrounded by army camps. And the rate of incoming recruits into the army, volunteers as they were in those days, was actually a figure of about 32,000-33,000 a day, which equaled the annual personnel coming in before the war. So the army was quite pushed to develop things quickly. So the development of Concord, and in fact the amazing success and prosperity that Concord experienced in the First World War, was quite dramatic, especially compared with Imber, its neighbour 8 miles away, who were hardly impacted by the First World War. And of course, by the time you come to the 1920s and 1930s, the time of the Depression, it's interesting to see how agriculture itself was developing. The natural fact that the farmers around Imber could hardly afford to buy the equipment they needed to mechanise. So they weren't actually having such a great time. then you talk about some of the couple of larger houses in Imber. The residents here, they said, to hell with this, you know, we're not going to keep on being depressed about the way this is all going. So they started to develop, if you like, shooting weekends and tennis weekends and what have you. And the lady used to talk about, who lived in the house, about the men used to be up partying all night, and the visitors, and they go out and milk the cows for her, still in their tails, at 7 o'clock in the morning. So it wasn't all negative, but it was something that they thought back on. Yeah. And as I said, by the army then started to take over. They started to purchase land. They became the landlords, and that's really set the tone. He did actually discuss about 1934 about actually just taking over Imber and getting rid of the residents. Getting rid of them, I mean, that's my terminology. Moving the residents out, because they thought this would be a darn good idea. So that there was nobody living there and they could have their live firing area. Then they dropped that. They talked themselves out of it. But that's interesting because it was never mentioned during the Second World War that they had considered this previously. And I don't think the villagers were ever aware of that. But it's certainly in the records held at Kew. You know, they were discussing this, I think it was 1934. And so, of course, you could then come to the Second World War. Initially, very little going on. There was one of the guards regiments was east near Codford. And again, the guards regiments had got on very well with the locals. And the children used to go out and watch them practicing their tanks. And then they pulled out. And nothing was happening until the Americans started to arrive about the middle of 1943. And then it was going on towards, as I said, the meeting in November, where the Americans were pushing to get a huge area, as big an area as they could. And the area they were given on Salt Ukraine, they were hardly impressed with. But never mind. That's all we have available for you to practice, because everybody was trained up by the time they arrived, but they need to keep the pressure on and keep on practicing for what was going to happen in June. There we go.
Okay, so also, it was a bit of a milestone last year. I believe it was the last person from Imber was actually buried in the church, one of the last residents, original residents. Mourners celebrated the life of one-time resident Ray Nash, who the Ministry of Defence permitted to be buried, actually, in the village of Imber. That's in, just looking at that's January this year. 100 mourners attended the ceremony, but it was the very last one, really, of the people who were original residents, it seems. So there's kind of a line been drawn under this now, I think, don't you?
That name, Nash, does go back into the history, because I think, what was it, about 40% of the villagers, if you look at the census, shared five surnames. And there was a village blacksmith called Albert Nash who died just a couple of days after they all left the village. So he was actually the first one to be returned back from burial at St. Giles Church. So maybe it was a relative of his. I don't know, but there we go.
Yeah, is there anywhere that listeners can follow your work online or on social media, that sort of thing?
I'm just an old man, really, into that. You know, it doesn't. I'm not in it for publicity. If anybody would like to read it, I'm happy to give it to them. That's the best I can know.
Just give us the title of your dissertation, then, please.
A Tale of Two Villages. Let me go to the top there, and then the subtitle is The Impact of War Office Ownership and Use of Land on Salt Ukraine upon Two Neighbouring Villages between 1914 and 1950.
Okay, Stuart Wakefield, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.